welcome to the July 2025 Club New Life Collective. I'm so glad you're here. It's Becky Brown, and we are celebrating the birthday of our country. You know, Independence Day is here, and I don't know if you like fireworks. I love fireworks. I'm the only one in my family that does, but it is one of my favorite things, whether it's 4th of July or just some other celebration. It's beautiful, and it's just a fun thing to do. So I don't know how you celebrate it. Maybe it's a picnic. Maybe it's family reunion, which could be challenging at best. But you know, when you think about our Independence Day, think about your own freedom. And isn't it incredible that God gives us freedom from our past, from our wounds? And we're celebrating that for each of you today. If you ever have anything that you're stuck in or you're feeling captive, give us a call. We're here for you. You know, we pray for you and love the opportunity to connect with you in that way. So we get together each month through our Club New Life Collective and want to spend some time with you and express our appreciation for you. I'm so grateful for each and every one of you and how you make a difference in people's lives. This month, we're going to share a testimony sandwich. Might I say a hero sandwich? With you. We'll start out with a couple of testimonies which show how you make a difference in other people's lives. And then we'll end the collective with a couple more testimonies. So you have to wait till the end to hear the rest of them. Our first segment features our New Life Live announcer, engineer, extraordinaire, Terry McIntosh, sharing a couple testimonies, followed by Chris Williams addressing slothfulness. Our first New Life Live call this month is from Jody. Chris Williams and Dr. Jill Hubbard answer her question on the differences between laziness and procrastination. Then Dr. Jim Burns and Dr. Jill Hubbard give advice to a dad who wants to encourage his 17-year-old son to get a job after graduation. Let's listen in.
Leah writes, I was going through a divorce and discovered you on the radio. You provide God's word with biblical counsel. What a win. Becoming a Club New Life member was a way for me to say thank you and encourage others to engage with New Life and find valuable resources for many seasons of life. And then Ralph writes, I was an active alcoholic for 38 years. I accidentally tuned into your New Life radio program on Word FM in Pittsburgh. Listening to your team, I have learned a lot. I sense hope as I listen to the callers as you counsel them. I believe your ministry is a good place for me to plant a seed and give back what had been given to me, a word of hope. I am now a member of Club New Life.
So I want to talk about one of the seven deadly sins that I have, and it's often in the Bible, it's referred to as slothfulness or laziness. Mm-hmm. So I have these bouts of laziness, and it's a predominant theme, especially in the book of Proverbs. Like one of the Proverbs says, lazy hands make for poverty, but diligent hands bring wealth. And a lot of people is like, oh, why am I struggling so much? Well, because you don't do anything. That's why you don't struggle. That's why you're struggling, you know. So it's similar to what I tell some of the players on my teams that I coach. Well, you know, why do I hit so poorly? Well, because you never practice. So sometimes 1 + 1 = 2. But with that said, on a deeper level, I think that there is a lot, I'm seeing a lot of this, especially in the clients that I work with. Mm. I see it in my own life. But it's just these bouts where we just zone out. Mm-hmm. We just tap out from activity, from life. And some of that's really healthy. We call that Sabbath. We call that rest. Mm-hmm. Other times, it's just this shutdown mechanism that creates its own momentum that actually puts us in great vulnerability or compromise, that we're no longer engaged in meaningful relationship, we're no longer engaged in meaningful work, we're letting go of responsibilities. And this could, as Proverbs said, this really can lead to ruin. And so I want to just talk a little bit about what are the things that lead to laziness. Because sometimes we just chalk it up to a pure character defect. And maybe that's the case, but most of the time it's not. Most of the time, two factors are involved in this tap out. One is fear and anxiety. And let's just fear and anxiety internally rips a lot of energy. It consumes a lot of calories and it can cause us to crash and burn. The other aspect of that is what we call avoidance. In fact, deep in our neurological processing, there is a term for this. It's called hypoarousal, where we just start to shut down. And so that's oftentimes due to being disconnected to positive energy sources in our life. That could be the fact that there is this yo-yo effect between overworking or overfunctioning and underworking and underfunctioning. It's like we run it fast, we run it hard, and then we hit burnout. And burnout is a dangerous place to be. It's compromised decision making. Again, it's a withdrawal. A lot of times we cope with burnout through addictive devices. The other aspect of that, though, is a lot of times I see that people have given up on hope or faith. There is a sense of despair and meaninglessness that sets in there. And so if you're struggling with this tap out and you have identified yourself as lazy or someone in your life as lazy, let's uncover the hood and see what's going on underneath that. And let's explore those. Give us a call today. We would love to explore that with you to see what's going on, because God has not designed us for laziness. He has designed us for creativity and productivity and deep relationship.
I really like what you were talking about, Chris, and I hate the word laziness because it's so negative and self-degrading.
Yes.
And I don't think most people are lazy.
Yeah.
I think, like you described, there's other things going on. And I really feel like we don't know how to truly rest. Nowadays, we're so overstimulated and we do a lot of numbing that perpetuates our anxiety, but doesn't really allow ourselves to rest. And I think that is problematic for people. So people just want to escape.
Well, it's problematic in my own life, because that's one of the problems is that numbing and resting are two different things.
Yes.
And for a lot of us, including myself, we have to learn how to rest. And it's really important, because that is a renewable, reusable energy source that is so critical to life.
Have you ever gotten into rest mode and then instantly something pops into your head? Oh, I got to go do that.
And yes.
There and you goes grab your phone or you do that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Man, we all need help.
Stop telling on me, Brian.
Yeah.
Chris had mentioned laziness, and I don't know, I just associate laziness with such a bad term, but I feel I'm more a procrastinator than a lazy person. And I'm just trying to understand, maybe I am more lazy, but it's just very hard for me to get going to start a project or a do something, and I procrastinate and then try and do it like for 5 minutes, basically.
Okay.
The last to get it done.
So let me
and maybe do a sloppy job.
Well, because I want Jill to jump in on this, because I think she has a lot to say on what goes on underneath the hood when we procrastinate. But I just want to start with this question. When you're facing a task, what is your fear telling you?
That I really don't want to do it.
Okay, stay there. Why do you not want to do it?
Well, some things I want to do, but if it's something that's kind of monotonous and boring, I just can't seem to get
there.
Started.
Okay, okay, Jill, you're on.
So,
you're on
so
up to bat.
You don't. You do the things you like. It sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do.
But you.
But as far as like certain chores or certain things around the house, and I'm like, I've got to clean out this closet, and then I get overwhelmed when I go open.
Yeah, but who wants to clean out a closet?
I know,
mean, you would like
afterwards,
that.
Afterwards, it makes me feel good.
Yes. Okay. So you want the end result, but the actual doing it is not really fun. And there's a lot of tasks that we put a lot of shoulds on and shame attached to it, or conditions. I've got to clean out my closet before I can do such and such. Right? I really should clean out my closet. Oh, I'm such a lazy person. Look at my closet. And we judge ourselves.
Yeah, then I feel bad.
Yeah, then you feel horrible about yourself. And so you're just perpetuating all of these bad feelings. And who doesn't want to avoid bad feelings? Now, the thing is, you're creating more bad feelings through the avoidance. But sometimes our brain kind of switches it around. It's like, I don't want to face that because then I'm going to have the bad feeling. So I'm going to do it, but I'm going to put it off as long as I possibly can because I just want to enjoy what I'm doing right now. So, and sometimes we always usually get stuck in that. And sometimes there are things that we need to reevaluate our expectations of ourselves. You know what? Really good people have messy closets. Yes, it would be nice if it was organized. It may make you feel better. But it is not the end of the world if you have a messy closet. And those are not the, the life and death circumstances that you need to flog yourself over.
Oh, I think I have one.
Okay.
You ready for this one?
Yeah.
Thank God for the last minute because it gets a lot of things done.
Well, yes.
Right?
You know what? You know when my closet gets clean is when I have to do something
yes.
else I don't
yes.
like.
So I'm a last minute person and that's okay.
Yeah. Yes, when I have to like pay my taxes.
Yes.
Boy, my closet has never looked cleaner. It's so one of the tricks, Chris,
yes.
that you're reminding me
yes.
of, find something else that you hate even more than the task you're avoiding.
Yeah, yeah. Thank God for the last minute. Honestly, it's a mantra in my own life. I thank God for the last minute because it gets a lot of things done.
Interesting.
That's my motto from now on.
Mm-hmm. And half of the people procrastinate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Half of the people mm-hmm. deal with their anxiety by planning ahead and doing things ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But half of the people in the world deal with their anxiety by avoiding it mm-hmm. and putting it off mm-hmm. until they mm-hmm. are in the crunch time.
Yeah.
And you know what? Mm-hmm. Both people get it done.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say that you're procrastinating, you don't mean super important things like you've got a stack of bills piling up or anything like that. It's just those things like cleaning out the closet and
that's a good point, Brian.
I mean, just things. Yeah, things. I mean, definitely nothing that's, you know, very critical.
You pay your bills.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Do that.
Okay.
It's more of, I guess, it's comparing to other people and.
Okay.
They're so organized and have everything
I know
in order
and good
like
for them.
I'm convinced half of them hire it out because how could you be that perfect, right?
Well, but again, I think it goes back to something that you said, mm-hmm. Jill. This is really important because what we do in comparison is three fallacies. Mm. The first fallacy is this. I'm comparing how I feel on the inside to how you look on the outside.
Yep.
A lot of people that get a lot of things done, my brother is one of those things. I know he does it from a place of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cousin to his OCD. Look at his garage. You know, I get mm-hmm. things done at the last minute. That's a product of my anxiety. Both are anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the other thing that we're doing comparison with is we're comparing like circumstances, you know, like in this particular area, you get things done. Maybe there's areas in which you don't, that I don't know. That's another huge fallacy. There's just too much information we don't know. The last fallacy of comparison is this, is usually when we're comparing, we're finding an excuse to give ourself a false sense of inferiority
mm-hmm.
and somebody else a false sense of superiority, or it could go the other way around. Either way, it's relationally disengaging rather than engaging. So acceptance of like, yeah, this is my MO. This is how I operate. I don't have mm-hmm. to like it all the time. But if I start with acceptance, now here is the real trick of acceptance. Once we've accepted it as a radical is, then we can begin to start making adjustments and changes to it.
We're running out of time. Quick question. Is procrastination a sign that perhaps we've got too much stuff going on in our lives and maybe we need to let go of some of that other stuff?
Well, that could be. And maybe we need to let go, though, more of our perfectionism and our expectations for ourselves.
Absolutely.
I think that's an important thing
in
the mix.
Joey in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on Sirius XM Channel 131. Hello.
How are you, sir?
Doing well. How can we help you today?
Okay, so my 17-year-old son, he's my oldest. This is my firstborn. He's just graduated from high school, and the plan was for him to attend lineman school nearby and go to train to be an electrical line worker. And I guess, I don't know, now that he's graduated, he'll be 18 in July. He's starting to get like anxiety. Mm-hmm. I guess starting life. I don't know. The school starts in September, and I told him he needs to get a job this summer to save money to support himself through the lineman school. It's a 12-week program. And I was like, it'd be a tremendous burden on your mom and I if we're having to, give you gas money and, if you're going to go, eat lunch out and stuff like that. Cause I mean, it's an all day. He's out in the hot sun all day working. So,
yeah.
I just wanted him, plus if he wanted to go to the movies or hang out, have a social life during that 12 weeks, he's going to have to be able to kind of fund it himself with money he saved.
Yeah. This is something we kind of mentioned earlier in the program, that it's graduation season and a lot of kids might be, now what? Now I've got to get out. I've got to get a job. I've got to become an adult. And it's
then they become a deer in headlights, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. So what advice would you give to Jerry?
Jerry, I think your son is going through, what a lot of kids do right now. They've just graduated and they're not sure they're confident enough to get that right job, or they want to play for the summer, things like that. And he sounds like your son is a good guy. He's going in a good direction. The phrase I use is experience is a better teacher than advice. And truly, if you say, hey, you have two choices. One is, to get a little job and, you're going to have to, if you want some money for the movies and you're going to have to, get ready for, this new world that you're in. Or if you don't, mom and I aren't going to be able to help with the movies, and we're not going to be able to help with, where you're going, and you may have to delay that direction. And, sometimes that notice where you're now not enabling dependence on you. Now, again, he's 17, so you got to be careful because he's really
young
still. He's really young. Most kids aren't graduating at 17. A lot of boys are graduating at 18 or even 19 these days. Mm. So, but I think it's the thing where, if you think it's best for him to get that job, then you are holding some purse strings even at 17. And that the purse strings, or your wife's purse strings, or your wallet strings, maybe we call it, is, it's, babe, now that you're out of high school, we're not going to cover this, or this. You're going to have to make that decision. And that might get him right up and go find a job.
But I would also talk to him about how he's feeling about it all.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Right? Is he feeling like, wow, high school was a lot and I got through it, and like you're saying, he just wants to play a little bit.
Right.
Is he scared to go get a job? Sometimes it's intimidating. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, so we literally had this conversation last night.
Okay.
And he was, I know I can come across, when I get into that dad mode, I know I can come across almost drill sergeant like, and I don't mean to, but I'm like, let's have a plan. Let's get a plan. Let's work the plan, and you'll see the results. You'll reap the results, the reward at the end of it. And he started getting real emotional during the conversation when I was telling him, like, son, you're your own person, but and you've always got a home here. If I've got food in my belly, you're going to have food in your belly. I'm just trying to prepare you to where you have some comfort, to where, because this school is hard, and you're going to want to have some evenings out and some weekends with
your
friends.
So, Joey,
I can't find that.
Yeah, let me just interrupt you. Everything you're saying is great, but I think there's a layer here. The fact that your son is getting emotional, I think you have to kind of go after the feelings first, right? Because you're giving him a practical plan that makes perfect sense and that he needs from a dad. But if he's not quite there yet, like, does he even want to go to lineman school? Has he had a change of heart? Why is he feeling emotional? What's going on inside of him? And I think as a dad to maybe, and this is a lot of times where moms come in, you know, we come in and are a little softer, and he needs your approach, but maybe the timing is just off. I think maybe you have to explore a little more with him first. And then when he says, yeah, I need a plan, like, is he on board with a plan? Mm.
And the question also is this your plan or is it his plan?
Yes.
Kids support what they help create. So with a plan in place, it would be really good to make sure that he has his insight too. And, you know, Jill just gave a great illustration. I came in, experience is a better teacher than advice. Let the kid get a job. Jill said, but what about his feelings? And so I think she's right. You lead with emotion, the emotional, you know, and not emotional like I'm talking about. He was upset yesterday and had, you know, some tears. But I'm talking about you lead with, you know, what is he feeling? Buddy, what are you feeling right now?
What are your tears saying?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah. And when a dad does that, that's a good thing, by the way, a really good thing.
Our brains contain billions of nerve cells arranged in patterns that coordinate thought, emotion, behavior, movement, and sensation. We are complicated beings, and New Life Live receives many calls in this area. Susie recently asked Mark Cameron and Dr. Alice Benton about EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Following is a short teaching by Mark on how the brain stores memories.
Susie, who's listening to the New Life podcast. Hi there, Susie. Welcome to New Life Live.
Hi. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for calling in today. How can we help you?
Well, I had a question about EMDR, but I'm going to give you a quick rundown of kind of what's going on in my life.
Okay. Really quick, so, for anybody who doesn't know, what is EMDR?
Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, a treatment modality that helps tap into subconscious emotions and negative beliefs that hamper our ability to function today.
Okay. So, Susie, what's your story?
Okay. So, I'm 33 right now. And when I was between the age of 9 and 12, I was molested by a brother that's 7 years older than me. And so when it was caught and stopped, I come from a very religious family, like not in a healthy way. And so my dad told me, I was 12 years old. He said that biblically I should have been stoned to death. And so that kind of shut me up. My mom told me I should carry the shame. And again, that shut me up. I was quiet about it for many, many years. There's 9 of us siblings, and 2 of my older brothers were told about it, and they told my dad that he needed to get help for us, but he didn't believe in counselors or, you know, major fear of the government, all that stuff. So, anyways, when I, about, 3 years ago, I started having some triggers of stuff. I have a daughter that was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. I have 3 kids. I'm married. And it started coming back, and that brother that did this, he had gone on to get married, and he had 1 biological son, had 3 adopted children, many foster children in and out of his home. And it wasn't until those triggers came back that I started being very concerned about his lifestyle and where he was, what he was doing. And so I told my whole family, and I felt like I was hurt at the moment. But then once I started, you know, triggers and memories and everything start coming back even more, I was like, no, this isn't safe. He needs, you know, he shouldn't have had the kids. And then his wife called me and told me that I need to be quiet and not tell anyone, which really set me off. So I ended up going to the police and reporting him, and my family, all but 2, pretty much turned their back on me. And so I've been going through this journey, and I went to several counselors, and one of them had me do EMDR. But we never got to the situation, and we were dealing with other, because my family has a lot of issues. We're dealing with other issues in the family, just to kind of build me up. But it was really stupid for me. Like, I am a very strong person and like held my life together through all of this until, you know, it's been rough, but I'm not like a super emotional, I don't think negative thoughts about myself. And the counselor that was doing this with me, she said, like at one time I was like, I don't understand. What am I supposed to do? She wanted me to find a safe person or something. And she's like, it doesn't matter. It could even be Mickey Mouse. And I was like, oh my gosh, like I am not an imaginative person like that. Anyways, so I'm at the point where, that brother is in jail right now waiting sentencing. And, when I read my victim's statement, my dad was there and, he saw me come in, he turned his back on me. And that was probably, like, to me, he's dead to me now. Because he's known about this for years and he never spoke up for me before. And I can understand that he's, his excuse before was, but he didn't know all the details. And now he knows and he still turns back on me. So, I've been told by my counselor that I have right now, I have a new one and I really, really like her, but she feels like we need to go to the EMDR. That's the next step. And I'm kind of afraid because it didn't turn out well last time. And with my, I don't feel like going through the abuse is hard for me to talk about. I can talk about it with anyone. I have a pastor and lots of mentors that have been in my life. And I have a lot of people, not family, but a lot of people that have been very solid.
Susie, I'm going to interrupt with a question. As you have a lot of doubts about EMDR, and understandably so, and you don't think that the abuse itself is what's really still impacting you, maybe more your family's rejection of you, what would you say is one of your most difficult, chronic, uncomfortable emotions that comes up when you think about your family turning their back on you?
I don't know. Just the abandonment, probably. Because they didn't know before, and then now they knew. And for 3 years, they've known, and they keep defending him. And his lifestyle that he's living since I came out about this, he has his one biological son that was around 10 years old when I came out about it. And he, since then, is changing him to be a transgender. And his wife left him to be a lesbian. She's engaged to another lesbian. And he still has, well, not now, he's in jail as of last month, but he still has children in and out of his home that are not foster, but like his adopted children. And he has two girls that were around my age.
It's almost as if your report to the police pulled the covering, the hiding off of what was going on. And so the whirlwind was unleashed. It was always there, but it was under deception and under a covering. And so your report revealed more of the truth of what actually has been happening in this family. You said abandonment is the strongest emotion that you've been having. How does it negatively impact your ability to function today? Where are you finding that you're struggling in your life because of this immense pain and betrayal?
Well, I live close to a lot of my family. We lived on the same family farm. My dad had put in a trust. So just this year, my husband and I moved off because it was too hard. And so just like I have one sister. I have seven brothers and one sister. My sister's the oldest and I'm next to the youngest. And she's the most against me. And I think it's because of her own skeletons in her own marriage. That she's protecting, but like she'll come and visit at the family farm and like pick and choose who she's going to invite to like her daughter's engagement party or a Mother's Day event. And the two brothers that did stand up for me, they are also being rejected and pushed out. And so we all have kids. We all have a bunch of cousins together. And it's just like pain for my brother. I have one brother that's been solid the whole time and he's just been so like there for me, but now he's feeling what I've been feeling for 3 years because he made a stand and was there for me at the hearing and made a statement for me. And it just hurts that they're
being punished along with you.
So
what I'm hearing is the two major things that are so troublesome is the ongoing rejection. Every time there's an event, you experience rejection, but also the protectiveness you feel for your brothers who have aligned themselves with you and are therefore suffering. And so that's why you're wondering, might EMDR help with all the complications of what's going on? It didn't seem to help before.
Well, I'm hearing you also talk about or ask this question about a negative belief. You said, I'm not a negative person. And
therapist, part of EMDR is identifying the negative self-belief and then learning to change that. Is that part of your question here? I know you were talking about having a safe person too.
Yeah, I feel like my husband has been there so much for me, and I have a lot of people that have spoken truth into me. And so I know the truth about things. I don't, like, I have mind games sometimes, but I know what is true and what the Bible says and what God says about me. I don't struggle with, you know, lies about these situations or who was my, you know, when I did it the last time, there was just so many, like, okay, imagine a safe place and I'll put this in a box. And I'm like, I don't need imaginations. Like, I just need facts. Like, I don't really know what I need. I don't feel like imagining safe things and all of this. It seems fake to me.
So here's my thought on this, Susie. I'm a believer in EMDR. I'm EMDR trained. And so as Alice was saying in her explanation, EMDR gets underneath the subconscious thing. So when something is subconscious, it's unknown to us. And so whenever we have experience, we have belief. You know, when I drove here today and I drove my car to 75 miles an hour on the freeway, you know, it's because I believed I was going to be safe. Because I believed my brakes were going to work. I didn't think about that when I accelerated, but it's a subconscious belief. And so we all have these subconscious beliefs, and that's what EMDR does. It helps to get underneath that. Now, where I think you may be struggling is I think there's probably a little bit more in your childhood of how you've been impacted. I think you've likely developed more of an avoidant attachment style, and people who are more avoidant, they do struggle with EMDR because they're more in the facts, they're more in the digital left mind, which is, you know, up, down, left, right, wrong, and they struggle to get into the right side of the brain, which is the creative part of the brain. And so, part of EMDR is doing the safe, calm place at the beginning to be able to learn to ground yourself. And it's also being able to work on it, identify the subconscious negative belief. Because if you don't identify something, you can't work on it. But there is a belief there. And so what your therapist may need to do with you is help you learn how to access that creative part of your brain before you can move forward. But there is a negative self-belief there. And I think you, because of the avoidant attachments, though, I think you've probably been used to dismissing what you feel and being told to think about, you know, good things or scripture or the positive side of life.
Yeah, you probably intellectualize a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's your strength. It's helped you keep your head above water. And it's helped you feel like, I don't think those things affect me. And you really may have processed through so much already that the trauma doesn't hold strong power over you. That may be true. But EMDR, oddly enough, it can also be used to help you figure out, why am I so opposed to it? And even in processing that, you said something about fear of going back to EMDR. It can help you tap into these emotions that you may not have enough access to be able to fully grieve the historical pain, but also the ongoing rejection that you feel. You probably are feeling fear for your 9-year-old daughter, and it's so common that a trauma that occurred at about that age, it comes to the surface in a different way when our children are at a vulnerable age to suffer something similar. And so working through what your fears are for your children and what your fears are of how this will play out in your family, have you lost the majority of your family? There's probably hurt there that you compartmentalize by intellectualizing it. And so I bet Mark and I both think it's probably worthwhile to try EMDR again, because once you get past that safe place and that safe person setup, that's when you get into the really more significant, deeper work of dealing with the resulting pain and the maladaptive beliefs that might be stuck inside you.
Well, and then think about this too, Susie. The fact that it went 21 years before something came up for you shows that that belief was inside of you for 20 years that you weren't aware of, you weren't able to access. And it was only when the association of your daughter being the exact same age that triggered something. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I'm not safe around my brother. Other people are not safe around my brother. That was the negative self-belief that came up for you, but you weren't aware of it because it was below the surface. Mm-hmm. So last week, my wife and I were walking through a state park. It was quite quiet out. There's no one else around. It was close to sunset, clear trail ahead. Now, I've always thought it was unrealistic in scary movies when somebody walks up onto danger and they just don't see it there at all. But now I get it. About 10 feet in front of us, there was this rattlesnake just crossing our path. And I was talking with my wife and she was on her phone and I looked up and I saw it and I grabbed her arm and we both froze. And then for the rest of the walk after that, every time I grab my wife's arm, she froze again. And that's the work of the amygdala. That's the part of our brain. It's our threat detection center, and it stores memories, especially memories that are linked to danger, and it uses them to prepare us for similar situations in the future. And it triggers us into fight, flight, or freeze responses, which happen often before we're even consciously aware of them. So in the moment we saw the snake, we went into a freeze response. We just stopped right in our tracks, and we let it just go away, go on its way. And then about 10 minutes later, I saw something else on the path. To be fair, it was a lizard, but it was one of those long lizards that actually do look like a snake. And so I grabbed her again, and she froze again, and we both froze. And then any time, like, I saw something, I touched her arm, and just the same things happened. But these survival responses, they show up in our relationships too, especially during conflict, and they're based on our attachment styles, which in our attachment styles are how we've learned to bond and our bonding experience, which is shaped by our early childhood experiences. And so emotional avoiders, they tend to flee when it comes to conflict. They withdraw, they avoid emotional intensity both in themselves and in others, and because they've learned, well, people won't meet my needs. And so for them, it's everyone's for themselves. I deal with my stuff, you deal with your stuff, and when it gets heavy, I'm out of here. People pleasers and victims, they tend to freeze. They freeze and please and appease, and they just want to keep the peace at all costs, and they still believe that they're too small to protect themselves. And then controllers and vacillators. Vacillators are someone who idealize relationships, and then they get deeply disappointed when things don't turn out the way that they hope. They go to a fight response. They confront, they pursue, they react intensely to hurt because they're oversensitive to criticisms and complaints. Now, these reactions are deeply rooted in what we learned as kids. But here's the thing, the danger we're responding to now is really often a false alarm. It's like a smoke detector that goes off in your house when you're burning the toast. Or it would go off with the same intensity whether your house is burning down or you're burning the toast. And so we overreact. And so in order to shift out this reactivity, we need to learn how to pause and say, what am I feeling right now? What just happened? How am I reacting? And where in my past did this come from? Now, in the book of Nehemiah, the prophet who led the Israelites to rebuild the city walls of Jerusalem, the people come to him and they say, they complain about the nobles and the officials who are taking advantage of them. And Nehemiah says, when I heard the outcry of these charges, I was very angry. And then I consulted with myself. Or another version says, then I thought about it. And so we need to be like Jeremiah. We need to learn how to stop and pause and consult with ourselves and think about it. Where is this emotion and reaction coming from inside of me so that we can learn to take a more adaptive response in those moments?
This next section features J.J. West and Dr. Jill Hubbard responding to Joy's question. Her teenage daughter sent inappropriate pictures on her phone. Next, Mark Cameron and Dr. Alice Benton offer advice to a young married man who finds himself trapped in the addiction of pornography.
Let's talk to Joy in Conway, New Hampshire, listening on Sirius XM channel 131. Hi there, Joy.
Hi.
Hi, how can we help you today?
So I'm looking for just kind of some next steps or what to do about a situation that we've found ourselves in. So I found out that my 16-year-old daughter, who has a cell phone, has sent inappropriate pictures to the boy that she was having conversations with. So I had a conversation with her just asking her about it to begin with, because I found out about it from the boy's mom because she found him on his phone. So anyway, I had a conversation with her. She explained it. She's like, I know what's wrong. I'll take consequences, whatever. And then I had a conversation, like, how did this come about, things like that. So the thing that we've done is we've blocked her phone. We've restricted her access. She only has 2 hours a day where she's allowed to have the phone, and she's usually, like, you know, supervised when she's on it. Like, she can't have it in her room,
whatever. I'm looking for more information on what to, like, how to, where do we go from here? Like,
yeah.
I think she was very much, like, you know, involved. She really liked him. Mm-hmm. She thought he liked her. He lied to her. Like, she's very upset about it, the whole thing. But I just don't know how to help her know, like, right, what to do, what not to do. Like, I'm just like, how did we get here? You know, because I'm not. I understand where she's coming from. I know why she did it. I don't think she knows the fallout from it.
Right. So she's a little naive, is what you're saying?
Very, I think.
Yeah.
So and I feel like I failed her in that. And
so, Joy,
I just don't know.
I know. And that's hard. And those are feelings that you can share with her dad or with your friends. But in terms of right now, you need to not fail her. Right. And I'm not sure you failed her because we can't control every variable in our kids' lives. But this is something that she's dealing with, and stepping up as a mom is important. So you're curbing the behavior because she doesn't seem to understand the right and wrong of it. Or
well, she said she knew it was wrong and she held
but she
out,
still did
but
it.
And she caved. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that's good that there's consequences around that. But more importantly is the question you're asking, how did we get here? And what is her understanding of relationships? And what is her ability to say no or to not succumb to people pleasing or pressure?
Right.
Or sometimes when someone likes us, it's like a spell comes over us and then we give all our power away. And so she's doing that as a girl. And so I think those are important conversations, as well as maybe she, you know, maybe you have her go to therapy to talk about this. Like, let's do some learning and growing in the areas of relationships. And it's really common for young girls to not have a voice. And she needs to start having more of her own voice. Right.
Right. How do I help her do that? Because she said that to me. She's like, I don't know, Mom. She's like, I don't know why I'm such a people pleaser, but I want everybody to like me. And I see that in her, but I don't know how to help her understand.
Right.
That she
so
has
what is she?
Value.
Right. What is she afraid of? If she says no, if she doesn't do what people want, if she doesn't answer a question that's asked of her, then will people not like her? And that fear can be so great. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's like our kids' temperament. They're just more timid. Sometimes there's something maybe earlier on in life that caused her to feel like she couldn't speak up. But this is where you're at with her. So it's really important that she learn those assertiveness skills.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Would How We Love Our Kids be a good resource, you think?
Sure. Joy.
Yeah. So can I also add, it's so often that our good hearts get us into trouble.
Yes.
And and so what I would encourage you, Joy, is to share with your daughter that what she desires in terms of wanting to please people, that's a good desire. It's a good desire that we want people to like us. We want to be accepted. We want to be desired. And in this particular case, to have that romantic feeling, that romantic desire that somebody else on the planet wants me, desires me, finds me attractive. Those are good things that are built into us by our loving Father. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that sometimes our good hearts take us away from God and away from healthy interactions. And so what we don't want to do is shame her. Oh, I can't believe you did this. And why are you? Yeah, and especially we don't want to jump on the train of you're right. You are a people pleaser, and you know, because she's already feeling shame for that.
Right.
So, to instead come alongside and say, of course, it feels good when people like us, and of course, we have that desire. What we don't want to do is let that desire that other people like us and accept us and find us attractive. We don't want to let that take control of our decisions. It's a good desire, but we keep it subservient to my command to trust God And so going back to Jill's point, right? Like when I'm so afraid that someone won't like me if I say no, or I'm so afraid that someone won't like me if I don't go along with whatever it is that they want to do, I'm letting them be in control of my life rather than God being in control, and letting them define who I am rather than letting God define who I am. So I want to be able to understand, honor the desire, but not let the desire take control where it's taking me to places that are unhealthy in my relationships.
And then I think you can also practice with her, Joy, you know, set up scenarios where you can kind of role play and help her practice to say no or to have her own opinion. And instead of just talking at her, you want her to start articulating more. Like you said, you knew it was wrong. So let's talk this through and let her articulate, because that's how we learn.
While she's practicing, you can be the bad guy. Yep. I let my kids do this. Like, look, if it's hard for you to say no, you can just say my parents won't let me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Very true. Now we're going to talk to Andrew in Reno, Nevada. Hi there, Andrew. It says here you're a first-time listener. Thank you so much for calling in today. How'd you find out about us?
Thanks for having me. My wife's Nana sent the show to me over Facebook.
Great.
Thank you, Nana.
Yes.
How can we help you, Andrew? It's brave of you to call.
I'm just lost at the moment. I've suffered with porn addiction my entire life. When things got hard or like I didn't fit in as a kid, and like I had divorced parents and stuff, so that was my advice. And before we got married, she had caught me and she had said, the next time that I catch you doing this, I'm going to leave. Well, I got counseling after that and I felt like I had dealt with it. And then we got married and I felt all of the burdens and I felt like all the pain fall off, and I felt pure. But lately I've been feeling not happy in our life, and I resolved back to porn, and now she's ran away to a different state, and she's not communicating with me.
Oh. Wow. Andrew, do you have children together?
No, we're 22 and 19.
So you're newlywed still?
Mm. Yeah.
How painful and shocking, even though that was the threat she made, but for her to go so far, did she go back to family, or why did she go to another state, do you know?
So what had happened was my mom was going to have surgery, so I was going to be down with her for a little bit, and she took that opportunity to leave because it had happened a couple days before, and I knew she knew, and I kept asking if she was okay, and she wouldn't talk to me, and she was sleeping on the couch, and then once I left, she packed her stuff, and she left.
So how long have you been married, Andrew?
Since September of last year.
Okay, so less than a year. And are you in contact with her family? Are they reaching out to you?
Yeah, I'm actually at my in-law's house right now.
Oh.
Okay, so they're wanting you guys to restore, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and are they in contact with her?
Pretty much no. She's cut everybody besides her best friend that she's up there with and her online friends.
Yeah, so Andrea, while this is so deeply, deeply hurtful and confusing for you, she's having a betrayal response here. And so, you know, when you have a betrayal response, you want to run away from the thing that is hurting you, from danger. And so she's also incredibly young. I think you said that she's 19 years old. Is that correct? She's 19, you're 22. Yeah, yeah, so mm-hmm. she's still a teenager. You're both still very, very young. And so she may not know really how to handle something like this in a productive way to be able to talk through this and deal with it as a couple. And you're so newly married too. I think it's a good thing that you are in contact with her in-laws and they're wanting you guys to learn how to restore. I think the best thing you can do for yourself right now, as painful as it is and as much as you want to get in contact with her because there's all of this unknown of what is happening and where is she and, you know, can we even save this, is to start to get into your own recovery process, because that's how you become safe when somebody feels betrayed. It's learning to recognize, you know, why you use porn. It sounds like you use porn as a mood lifter. It's a way to give a dopamine release and help you feel better. And people generally use pornography because they have uncomfortable emotions that they don't know how to deal with. And so I think as you get into a recovery program and you find out the why, it's not just about sobriety. It's finding out what's drawing you to pornography and working on the root cause of that. I think that's the best thing that you can do in this moment, is to work on yourself as you become safe. Hopefully as she grows and matures and gets back into contact with her family, then you can start to work on mending the relationship.
Andrew, right. You already were in counseling, and so we praise that. You've had the humility to know, I need help with this. You may just not have gotten enough help or for a long enough period of time, because when you're struggling with a lifelong addiction, most of us need both individual counseling, but we also need a group to be in. And men especially need other men who are in the same battle and want sexual purity so that you all can lift each other up. The Bible says we need a triple braided cord. When one falls down, we need the other one there to lift him up, because we're all going to face the difficulties in early marriage and then having kids. And it becomes so overwhelming that we default back to our old way of coping. And knowing, Andrew, that you have used porn your whole life, I want to try to help lift some of the shame. You were an innocent victim who was exposed to pornography at what sounds like a very young age. And probably your parents didn't realize, didn't know how to handle it or address you and know how to help you through it. Most parents, we don't even know how to teach our kids to handle their emotions. And so everybody goes to cope with something. We find a way to medicate so that the pain can become more tolerable. And this was one of the ways you figured out how to medicate. Is my description somewhat accurate as to your childhood?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How young were you when you were first exposed to pornography?
I think I was like 10 or 11.
Ah, so young.
Wow. And did you have anyone who you could go to and talk with about that?
I felt ashamed of it, so I didn't talk to anyone about it.
Yeah, and that's very, very common. And that's why, because porn usually happens in privacy, in the dark, you know, and that's how shame thrives. That's why the recovery process needs to be in the light, in a group with others, and that's how you get set free from the shame.
And Andrew, you're right to have something we call godly sorrow, which means I broke my wife's trust and I'm not a safe man to her right now, at least in this area. And so to feel bad about it is not an unhealthy thing. Godly sorrow is good, but worldly sorrow is shame and unhealthy guilt that we just beat ourselves up with. Maybe we give up. I'm not even worth it. I'm not worth living. I'm just the scum of the earth because I did this. And those are lies that the enemy wants us to believe to keep us stuck and to keep us from repentance. So you called the right place, Andrew, because this particular struggle with pornography, it's what New Life Ministries specializes in. We help hundreds, if not thousands, of men every single year to come out and stay out. I get to work with a number of men who've been through one of our programs called Every Man's Battle, which is an intensive workshop we have, and we want to make sure we get you to it, Andrew. Some of the men I work with, they're able to say, I have 10 years of sobriety, 15, 20 years of sobriety. I don't even feel tempted anymore. Or when I'm tempted, I know exactly what to do to defeat that temptation. meditation, and my wife now trusts me. And so, Andrew, we can get you set on that path. We also have an intensive workshop for the women who have been betrayed. Because your wife doesn't know how to handle the emotions that she's feeling, our weekend for women is called Restore, Healing After Betrayal. And both these weekends are coming up, and so we want to get you connected with one of our counselors, with our men's groups we have, with this intensive. We have all the right strategies and solutions that will help you get out, stay out, and give you the best chance at restoring your marriage.
Our final two teachings will highlight Dr. Jackie Mack Harris on the subject of comparisons. It's actually one of our New Life videos, and you know there's over 600 of them. You can go to newlife.com and find them there. And then Dr. Sherry Denham Keffer on lying and how Satan is in the details. Let's listen in.
I've been thinking about the ways in which we don't take care of ourselves. We had a women's seminar a couple of months ago, and we talked about comparison. And I hear so often how women are pitting themselves against one another and how little love we show ourselves. And even in Christianity, where we have a call to, you know, love God with all our heart, soul, and mind, and love others as ourselves. And the self is getting left out of that. And so I've just been thinking a lot about how do we navigate self-love. Like, I am okay. I am enough. And loving every iteration of myself, because I was doing the best I could at the time. And that version of me was a part of the journey to this version of me, and I love this version of me, and so I'm working at loving the past versions of me that maybe didn't make the choices that I would make now, because I survived whatever that season was. And so I'm wondering what it's going to take for people to be able to give themselves permission to accept themselves. Self-acceptance and self-love, I think, go before healing. Because before I accepted the truth of my story and how it impacted me and how the kinds of choices I made to cope, I would not do anything because I hadn't accepted anything. And once I accepted that these were truths about me, and that is why I was so emotionally avoidant, then I could risk showing up emotionally in order to start to do the work to heal. And so I've just been thinking about, you know, let's move away from the competition. I have a t-shirt that says, I am my only competition. I'm not competing against anybody else in the world. God put me here for a reason, and I'm striving to live that purpose and love myself in the process. That.
I want to talk about lying. I want to talk about lying and what to do with lying. If you think someone's lying to you, or maybe if you're lying to somebody else, why is lying even a part of our lives? I think lying's a part of our lives because we don't want to take responsibility for something that we've done. That's the first thing. And two, we're trying to avoid conflict by not just letting somebody know what's true, what's real, what's gone on. I mean, I've had situations, and you guys can probably relate to this, where somebody lies about stopping and getting a Coca-Cola on the way home. Like, they will tell their spouse, oh, I was running late from work, or my boss gave me, but they just didn't want to share that they had stopped to get Coke. And some of us have grown up in homes where it wasn't safe to really share what was going on, where the truth, like there's, you know, alcoholic homes or abusive homes where, you know, we have avoided conflict by just learning how to lie. So let me talk about the different types of lies. So there's a lie of omission. What is that? A lie of omission means that you have something going on in your life and you're not exposing it. But it would be something that would cause a disruption in your relationship with your significant other if they were to find out about it. It might even break a vow, you know, that lie of omission. And you might say to yourself, well, I'm not really lying. I just didn't say anything about it. So that's another form of lying. What is that? That's called self-deception. Self-deception is when you lie to yourself. What's really interesting is that one of the names of Satan, our enemy, is the father of lies. And so I often see how the father of lies will just latch on to our relationships in order to bring more chaos, in order to keep things hidden in the dark, sins, things that would harm other people. I mean, I see his fingerprints all over the dirty work. And that doesn't make somebody not responsible. It's not like you can say the devil made me do it. But I'll tell you, the devil's in the details. And the devil is in the details of what happens with lying. So whether you're lying and it's self-deception, you're lying to yourself and others, right, ultimately, or whether it's a lie of omission, and then there could just be a flat-out lie. Somebody looks at you and says something, and then you say, no, I didn't do that. Or gaslighting, which is somebody looks at you, says something, and then they make it your problem. They twist the truth in order to make you feel wrong and bad about who you are and hide what's happening over there. So lying's hurt. Well, and then you might say, well, what do I do if somebody is gaslighting me or I feel like they're lying to me? I will look up the verse in a second, but I know one of the names of God is Jehovah Elameth. And Jehovah Elameth means the Lord God of all truth. And I think it's in the Psalms, but I'll look it up. And it says, though everyone else is a liar, God is saying about himself, though everyone else is a liar, I'm not. So I love that God loves the truth. One of the ways that you can hold on to your sanity and truth would be to keep it in a private note section of your phone, somewhere where your kids can't find it, you know, the one who's deceiving you can't find it. And just make sure your kids can't find it. And I'm sure, Alice, you'll agree with this, because so often kids use our phones for, I don't know, schoolwork or to look something up. And you don't want them to find this. But in your notes section, begin to write down what you saw, what you observed, like the facts. Because it can get very confusing when somebody's holding on to their lie, and you can really almost lose track of what you remember to be true. It's very disorientating. Another thing you can do is when someone's gaslighting you, telling you something's about you, you can say a phrase like this. You can say, that's interesting. That's not how I remember it. Period. That's not how I remember it. You don't have to be adversarial. You don't have to yell and scream. You can just hold your strength within your core and say that. You could also say, well, looks like we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one. That's another way. And then the scripture can be really grounding. And Alice, I just wanted to see if you had any ideas why I'm looking this up. You know?
Well, you're describing non-combative responses that, rather than escalating the argument, have such a likelihood of diffusing the situation. A soft word turns away wrath. And so to just give a, that's not how I remember it, it really stops an argument in its tracks. Sherry, you were talking about an easy fix. And it is, I think it's pretty shocking how much truth and confession are the easier, much more effective fix. Emotionally, it's very difficult for those of us who struggle with lying to make our confessions because we're so afraid of the response we'll get. But when we start to confess, if we have decent people around us, they will likely receive our confession and actually begin to believe us as we admit to these things we're so afraid to tell them. I learned from you, Sherry, how much disclosure versus discovery, if there's been an infidelity, for example, when the perpetrator discloses it rather than it being discovered by the victim's spouse, it ushers in a level of healing.
It sure does. It sure does. Because it's ownership, right? It's a way of taking responsibility. I want to read this verse. So it's Romans 3:3-4. It says, true. Some of them were unfaithful, but just because they were unfaithful, does that mean that God will be unfaithful? Of course not. Even if everyone else is a liar, God is true. And so it's just, I just want to say there's a beauty to truth. And even though people are scared, when I work with those that have infidelity, they're scared out of their mind to come clean. because they think they're going to, I mean, their belief is I'm going to lose my family. I'm going to lose the one I love. I'm going to lose my reputation. And those are a lot of reasons that people say, I'm just going to take it to the grave. But that stuff just eats away at you. It begins to erode you from the inside. And that's why Jesus says, confess your sins to one another and pray so you can have healing. So a lot of good truth. Mm-hmm. And I know we have calls to take, but thank you for letting
One quick comment I want to make, yeah. or question I want to ask about gaslighting. What is it in our mind? What is it in our psyche that makes us, when somebody lies about us, or like you say, turns the tables to make it seem like we're the ones at fault? Why is it that all of a sudden our minds start thinking, oh, maybe that is how it happened? Why do we start doubting ourselves when it was our lived experience? Why is it that now what this other person tells us, all of a sudden you're just confused?
Well, because they may share one little sliver.
Okay.
Like, you know, you've not been feeling well. Like, this is really your issue. Or, you know, they might add a little tiny bit of truth, but like 99.9% of it is a lie. Mm-hmm. But what happens with gaslighting, it's usually not one time. Gaslighting is a pattern where someone strategically twists the truth to make you believe something's wrong with you or you're crazy in order to cover up what they're doing over here. So that eroding, it's kind of like the Grand Canyon. You know, when the Grand Canyon first started, it might have just been a little trickle, just a little tiny river that a leaf went down. But now it's huge. And that's what happens with gaslighting. It begins to erode the sense of who you are, and you are spun out. When someone comes in and they've been gaslit, there's almost a hollow sense to them when they come in because their reality has been so broken and their intuition is compromised. So yeah. My goal is to help them get back into truth, mm-hmm. of what is reality.
Yeah.
We love to have our amazing Club New Life family be involved in our many opportunities. We've got some upcoming events. Every Man's Battle, July 18 through 20 in Dallas, and August 22 through 24 in Cincinnati. That's a new city for us. We haven't been to Cincinnati in a long time, but there's a lot of people that can drive there. And if you know somebody, send them our way. We'll help them get connected. Intimacy and Marriage is July 25 through 27 in Washington, D.C. And if you live in that area, or maybe you're going to be vacationing in the nation's capital, join us the evening of July 25th for a Club New Life gathering. You'll get to hear the first session of the Friday evening, and then we'll have a time of connection with, I'll be there, there'll be Brian Blomberg, you'll get to talk with JJ West, Laura Manja McDonald. It's a great time to get connected. And that doesn't matter if you're married or single. We want all of our Club New Life friends and family to be there. If you can join us for our Club New Life gathering, give us a call, 1-800-NEW-LIFE, and we'll get you all the details. One other opportunity I want to invite you to is Club New Life Zoom. It's August 6th, 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern. We'll send you a link, let us know, and we're going to hear from Stacy Sadler, who serves on our board, but she's also a speaker at Restore. She's going to share on the beauty of brokenness, how God redeems pain into purpose. We always love our times on our Club New Life Zoom where we get to actually see you on the Zoom. You can ask us some questions. You can ask Stacy questions about what she presents, and just a good time to connect. We will send you an invitation, but if you have any questions, you can always call us at 1-800-NEW-LIFE. And our Life Recovery Conference is coming up October 4th, and it's online. The title is Choosing Wisdom, and who doesn't need that? Our Life Recovery Conference is open to anyone, whether you are in recovery, curious about recovery, leading a group, or curious about leading a group, or maybe you're just curious and you want to learn something. It's going to be a great day. So, you know, a lot of times people ask me, what's new, Becky? You've had a lot of changes. Well, at the end of July, beginning of August, we're going to begin our brand relaunch. We've been working very hard these last months on a new website with all kinds of great ways for you to connect with us. So if you would be praying about that, but stay tuned because we'll send you the information. And of course, check in often and you'll see the updates. We're really excited about how this is coming along. And it's been a much needed improvement so that people can find new life. We don't want to be the best kept secret. There are many people that want to have the help and the hope that we can offer. Remember when I said we were having a testimony sandwich together this fine July day? We're closing out with two more testimonies. Thank you for making a difference. We'll see you in August.
I believe it was back in 2002 when I came across New Life Live following the death of my beloved husband, not realizing or understanding that I was in the midst of deep grief and not losing my mind. New Life quickly became my daily source of comfort, understanding, support, and guidance. Little by little, New Life not only helped me navigate through a long season of grief and subsequently other seasons of grief, but also helped me truthfully acknowledge other painful areas in my life which I had neglected for years. New Life's numerous resources and workshops inspired me to begin and to sustain my journey towards recovery over the years. The New Life counselors are a blessing to me, and I am grateful for this entire ministry. I'm not quite sure where my life would be had I not stumbled across this ministry. I believe that it was God that led me to New Life, knowing that this would be exactly what I needed in my life to let me know that my life still had meaning and purpose despite the shame and guilt of my past, and that God had forgiven me long before I finally forgave myself. Thank you for being such a vital part of my life. I am grateful. Because of New Life, I can now live my life in view of God's grace and mercy. I have discovered the unforced rhythm of grace by finding rest in Jesus and not living a shame-based life. Recovery is a great way to live life, knowing that no one can ever decrease my value in God's eyes, nor can I ever disqualify myself from His love. If I humble down and embrace my weaknesses, I shall live in my divine appointment, totally dependent upon God, and knowing that peace, calm, healing, and connectivity are on the other side of grief and pain.
I am the firstborn of a functional alcoholic. Eventually, I lost my dad to a murder-suicide. And I now, behind me in my early 60s, have four failed marriages. I made choices in men of people I thought I could fix. They all had some type of addiction, sexual, prescription drug addiction. And I just have learned so much by finding New Life over the last 10 or so years. I eventually became a Club New Life member. And I cannot say enough good things about all that you all do and the counselors that you have. Everyone is just absolutely wonderful. I have purchased your materials for use in topical Bible studies with women. I have given them as gifts and have told people to tune in. And I just think that this is just such a blessing what you all do, and it's such a help to so many people. And I pray that you continue to do it for as many years as the Lord allows you. And I thank you so very much for listening.